We've talked about the students' involvement in the protest movement, but the faculty, several of the faculty members, we all know, were opposed to the Vietnam War. How did they express their views to the administration about this subject?
Well, more than a few faculty, lots of faculty mm-hmm. were opposed to the Vietnam War. Lots of them were very sympathetic to the students' position on it, but a few of them were so concerned that they allowed their better judgment to get to take the back seat, and they participated in the marches, and they did they called off their classes, and they did all kinds of things. Well, even though many of us in the administration felt that their motives were right, we felt that their actions were wrong, and that closing down classes and going on little mini strikes and things like that were inappropriate. And I took the position on many of these that if they weren't going to do their job, they ought to be docked. They ought to pay for it. They ought to have the willingness to fulfill their convictions and the paycheck. So I took a rather strong position that people should be willing to accept their responsibilities as faculty members and carry on their academic responsibilities, but at the same time, if they wanted to protest and write letters to the editor and do all the kinds of things that people in an academic community do to express their position on issues, that was great.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't put up with people that wanted to disrupt the university as a way of demonstrating mm-hmm. their concern. So there were always a few of those people, and quite frequently they would get elected to the Faculty Senate, where they could have a forum for raising hell, and that was okay. We had a period there where Ed Young, for a variety of reasons, liked to have me preside at the Faculty Senate meetings occasionally. I don't know how frequently I did, but often enough so that I was comfortable in that role. And frankly, that was good training for when I became chancellor.
I'll bet.
But a lot of times these issues would come up that were very controversial, that where Ed was really being attacked by certain faculty members, and so I would preside at the meeting. And by and large, these were a fairly small group of faculty members, mostly from a few of them from the humanities, and a few of them from social sciences. And they would do whatever they could to embarrass the chancellor, to undercut the administration. They weren't very effective.
You mean just verbally, just
verbally,
bringing up motions and whatnot?
Yeah, just sort of harassing the Ed Young mostly.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't harass me nearly as much, and I guess that was because Ed was the chancellor, and he mm-hmm. was the symbol of the public image of the university, whereas I was, I suppose, viewed as being the guy that just shuffled papers. So when these things came up at the Faculty Senate meeting, my recollection is that we would always have three or four people get up and make these impassioned speeches and telling us what terrible things we were doing and how we ought to reorganize the university. And then there would be some sort of a vote on either cutting off debate somebody from the university committee that had some sense would get up and make a motion to limit the debate mm-hmm. or to do something like that, and it would be overwhelmingly approved. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of the issues had to do with whether we were going to give students an opportunity to speak mm-hmm. at the faculty senate meeting, and I was usually in favor of giving them some 5 minutes or 10 mm-hmm. minutes and letting them speak. But frequently that wasn't enough. They want to take over the whole faculty senate meeting. Mm-hmm. And so then we would have a debate over whether we would let them speak. There were always some faculty members who didn't want them to speak at all. Mm-hmm. And I was always in favor of letting them speak for some limited period. And usually my position would prevail mm-hmm. because the university committee position was usually about the same as mine. And then, of course, they'd get up and they'd want to continue on and on and on and on, and Ralph Hansen would have to escort them off the podium.
Oh, no. So students would attend the meetings students spoke. And all right. Were they in the Stock Pavilion as well?
No, they were in B-10 Commerce.
Oh, Commerce, yeah. That's a nice big one.
Yeah. The back 15 or 20 rows were reserved for visitors, and we would allow faculty members to mm-hmm. who were not senators to enter first, and then 5 minutes or so before the beginning of the meeting, any empty seats that were left could be taken mm-hmm. by students.
And did students attend pretty
a lot of them? Some, well, depending on
during,
the issue.
Yeah, on the issue, of course. Yeah. What was I going to ask? Were there ever any issues that you can recall where the faculty senate really went against the administration and challenged the administration regarding Vietnam policy?
I can't remember any where the majority went against the administration.
Okay. What about the university committee? I've talked to... I interviewed Ted Finman, and he said that Ed Young kept really, he'd stop in all the time and, you know, chat and everything like that, and there was a real good relationship there. Right. How about them during this period?
Well, that was the key to it. Yeah. You see, the university committee was the executive committee of the faculty senate, and the chairman of the university committee was the person that was the key individual in presenting faculty position papers mm-hmm. to the faculty senate. And it's absolutely essential that communication with the university committee had to be maintained. And Ed Young's relationship with the university committee was relatively informal in that he would wander in. You see, they meet every Monday mm-hmm. afternoon. I suppose they still do.
Mm-hmm. I believe so.
The whole afternoon. And Ed Young would wander in and talk to them for an hour or so and then leave. Sometimes he'd stay only 15 minutes, sometimes, but he always, every Monday, he made it a point to stop in and chat with the university committee for at least a few minutes mm-hmm. and to give them an opportunity to talk to him about things that they were concerned about. And that would give him an opportunity to develop a strategy for how they were going to handle the next faculty senate meeting, because coordination between the chair of the meeting, the chancellor, and the university committee was essential if you were going to get anything done in a faculty senate meeting, taking into account all the screwballs that were going to be making speeches mm-hmm. at one point or another. And I shouldn't use that term, screwballs, because some of the people were very dedicated and conscientious people who made very eloquent speeches on both sides of the issues, and for the most part, when the university committee and the chancellor's office had done their homework properly, everybody got a chance to speak, everybody got a chance to voice their opinions, and then when the vote came, it was really a well-considered sense of the faculty that was expressed. Now, sometimes the votes were fairly close, and occasionally you would have to have a count. You'd get a voice vote, and you couldn't tell, and then you'd have to have people raise mm-hmm. hands and Mm-hmm. And we'd have people designated to run up and down the aisles and count. But that happened relatively seldom, the close votes. But I can't remember the close votes being on issues where the administration had a particular position. The close votes were on changes to faculty governance. Mm. Those kinds of issues were frequently hotly debated. Now, at the same time that Ed Young dealt with the university committee on sort of a political basis, I dealt with them on more of an administrative basis, and that I spent much more time with the university committee than Ed Young did, and that I would go in there and spend most of every Monday afternoon with the university committee. And there we would talk about administrative issues. We would review decisions on the budget, for example. We would review strategies for faculty compensation proposals. I would share with the university committee our decision item narratives, the infamous DINs,
yes.
that had to do with, well, actually all of them, everything from the building program to the academic program, the physical plant, and everything. I would go over those DINs with the university committee so that they knew what we were proposing. And lots of times I got feedback from them that changed my priorities for establishing a budget request. So I found it an extremely valuable thing to be in close communication with the faculty through the university committee. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the keys to our being reasonably successful. I think that during the 2 years that I was gone, the people that succeeded me in the vice chancellor's office did not communicate with the university committee the way I had. And certainly when I came back as chancellor, I just blocked off every Monday afternoon and spent all Monday afternoon with the university committee. Unless some emergency came up, I was there.
Well, when we talk about your chancellor days, we'll certainly discuss the university committee, and I will have a list of you, for you, of the different people who served on the committee during those years. I didn't realize we would be talking about it today, or I would have brought a list, but are there any people during your vice chancellor years, any members of the committee that stand out in your mind as particular? I know it was a very strong, those were very strong years for the university committee. Are there any people in particular that leap out in your mind?
Well, there are a lot of them, but the problem is I can't differentiate between vice chancellor
okay.
and chancellor.
What I'll do is I'll
a lot of overlap.
I'll bring a list, and then it's I can't expect you to remember
Phil
all
Cohen,
these things.
Jim Bowers in business, very very
yes,
Jim Bowers guy, and that was a vice chancellor period. But I would have to look.
I'll bring a list for you.
Yeah,
no problem. We've talked about the Dow movement, protest movements when you were in chemistry. We talked about Kent State right away in your chancellorship, the black students thing, and then we move to Sterling Hall. Is there anything between the black students and the Sterling Hall bombing regarding the student unrest that is of particular
note? Well, I think
note?
The black student unrest came after the bombing.
After the bombing, okay.
My recollection
okay.
is that it came after the bombing, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure about anything anymore. But the bombing, of course, just was at that point the entire administrative activity changed direction so enormously. Mm-hmm. Ed Young just didn't spend any time at all on anything other than the bombing and the repercussions from the bombing. And those repercussions were more than just the explosion itself,
I can
tell you. The regents were very unhappy, the legislature was unhappy, the governor was unhappy, you see the fallout was not just the bricks and mortar. The fallout was budget issues, more bureaucratic control over the university, an intensification of auditing by the Legislative Audit Bureau, all kinds of things mm-hmm. like that were, I think, catalyzed by the bombing. And so we were completely distracted from doing anything constructive for a period of a year or more.
Oh my.
Because we were so busy responding to demands for more accountability on every conceivable issue you could imagine.
So give me some examples of that.
Well, reports on drugs in the dorms. Mm. Why does it cost so much to run the university?
Yeah.
What is your cost per credit in the law school? you know, these kinds of demands came up continuously. And yet at the same time, we had some very good friends in the legislature who helped us a lot. A couple of people that I can remember that I worked with very closely. One was Anderson. I'll think of his first name in a minute. Walter Hollander.
Mm-hmm.
Molinaro. Molinaro from Racine or Kenosha or something.
Yeah, one of those places.
Rough, tough guy. Always on the Joint Finance Committee. Always. He frequently used very rough language. He was always cussing at people. And I got along with him just fine because I would go talk to him and the first thing he would do would cuss me out as being one of those academic types, one of those
pointy heads as
yeah, it was worse than that. And he used really foul language. And when I first met him, I was intimidated by mm-hmm. that. And then, you know, I spent a lot of time in my youth on the Seattle waterfront, and mm-hmm. so I've been in places like mm-hmm. he talks about. And I was raised during the Depression in a very poor family. And I wasn't in... finally, one day I got really upset with him because he'd call me some nasty names and made some terrible comments about the university. And I just, I thought to myself that, you know, I'm never going to get anything out of this guy anyhow. He doesn't like me, he doesn't like the university, and he doesn't like teaching, he doesn't like research, he doesn't like anything. And so I let him have it. And I cussed him out using exactly the same kind of terminology that he had used on me. And all of a sudden, we became friends. And he was great. He would invite me into his office to have lunch with him. And so I didn't usually bring my lunch, but he would have his lunch. And he had ulcers. And so you know what this guy would have for lunch? He would buy a sack of peanuts, salted peanuts.
Oh, you told me about this.
And
drink
milk.
Yeah.
And have milk and peanuts, and he and I would sit there and we'd talk about what was coming up the Joint Finance Committee, and he was extremely helpful. Yeah. Norm Anderson,
there we go.
Norm Anderson was very, very helpful. Walter Hollander was very helpful. And Mrs. Hollander was the sweetest lady you could ever imagine, and she was always sitting in his office. You see, she was not exactly his secretary, but she was his assistant. Mm. See, I don't think she was paid, but she was lonesome sitting up in that Roseville or wherever she lived. And so she would be in his office all the time, and she was just the sweetest, nicest lady you could imagine. Right. And she and Walter were very, very helpful.
So during the post-Sterling Hall mess, they would come to the university's defense?
Yes. Occasionally they would help out.
Were there any legislators that you can recall who were leading the charge against the university?
I blanked those out of my memory.
I guess I can understand that. when I was talking to Gordon Orr about a month ago, he said that the day after, the morning after, or the day after the Sterling Hall bombing, he remembers going through Sterling Hall, walking through the rubble with you.
Yeah.
Do you remember that at all?
Yes, yes. It was a very embarrassing day for me because it seemed to me that everybody in the United States had heard the bomb go off and had rushed to the campus in the middle of the night. I didn't hear it. I had been in a sailboat race with one of my kids on Lake Wingra that day, and we had actually won. And I was absolutely exhausted and had gone to bed fairly early, and I went sound asleep. And we lived on the far southwest side of Madison, and I did not hear the bomb go off. And so I blithely drove into work the next morning, and as I got close to campus, I turned on the radio. I hadn't had it on earlier than that. And they were talking about streets being closed and police activity. I couldn't figure out what in the world was going on. And so I got to the office and found, and I looked at and saw what had happened and realized all the glass was gone. There were a lot of broken glass.
Oh yeah, right. Buildings all around.
And then that was when I first figured out what was going on. And I didn't really learn about it until about 8 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so by that time, Jim Edsel and Gordon Orr were around, and of course, the police all over the place, reporters all over the place. I did go through with Gordon, and I think there were other people with us. Trying to assess the damage, looking at the old chemistry building right across the way, which we were absolutely astounded that it hadn't collapsed because Joe Hirschfelder had made calculations decades earlier that showed that if an explosion of less than a kilogram of a kilogram of ether were to go off inside that building, the building would collapse, and use that as a way of justifying why we ought to have a new chemistry
building. Very clever.
The result of that was that the building was condemned, but we still stayed in it for many, many years. But in any event, the building didn't collapse. The bomb went off right next to it, and all it did was blow out a lot of glass. But we went through it. I remember that I was interviewed by one of these roving reporters from CBS News, and I was on national television night, and I got letters from people all over the country, former students and people that I had known, saying that they had seen me on television, and it was, I'll remember eventually the name of the reporter, but he was a very well-known national CBS reporter.
That must have been very interesting, all of a sudden Madison being the center of the national news media.
Yeah. And we stayed there for quite a few weeks, I'm afraid, as the search for the bombers continued. It was a pretty devastating period, and it... of course, it happened around the 22nd of August, as I remember, the 21st or 22nd of August on a Sunday night. And we were just starting to get ready for the beginning of the new school year, and it just threw everything into chaos. We had started a whole series of new administrative crises. For example, what was called the Army Math Research Center, which was the target, had to be moved, and we moved them out here to the Wharf Building, and director of the Math Research Center was a guy named Barclay Rosser, and he was very upset that we we refused to protect the math research center, and that we were moving them out to the Wharf building. They'd be isolated from the math department, and they would, and that they were no longer going to be a viable organization. And being in the Wharf building was a disgrace, worse than banishment.
Really.
And it was. I must have had more. I had more trouble with Barclay Rosser, I think, than with the Regents. And here we were trying to provide space for Barclay Rosser and his mathematicians where we could provide some reasonable security.
Yeah.
And we had guards in the front of the building here. Until fairly recently, we had guards on duty all the time in this building.
I would suspect that the occupants of Wharf were not exactly happy to have the Army Math Research Center moved out here.
But I thought that things would be, that this was, that they would be quite safe wherever they were, because once the bomb went off, people were so upset at this extreme violence that even the Army Math Research Center wouldn't be the subject of another attack in the near future. And furthermore, I was always concerned about the fact that it was misnamed the Army Math Research Center. Now, it was a math research center, but a lot of their funding, in fact, I think more than half of their funding came from the National Science Foundation rather than from the Army. And a lot of the Army research, all of the classified research that was going on there was conducted off campus. We wouldn't allow the classified research on campus. And so faculty members who wanted to do classified research as part of the Army Math Research Center activity didn't do it. They would stay on the payroll, but they would have to go to some Army base and do the work there. And the papers were there, the work was done there. Nothing classified was ever on campus.
So the name was just very unfortunate
that
contributed to it, certainly.
I just remembered that I was involved early on in the decision to remove all classified materials from the campus when I was chairman of the chemistry department.
In the late 60s.
Yeah. At that time, the university had a classified repository. It was left over from World War II, where some faculty members were working on classified projects for the military and for the Defense Department. And there was a big safe originally it was in Bascom, and then they moved it to the top of Van Hise, and it was full of classified documents that were left over from previous research projects. And the secretary of the faculty's office had the responsibility for guarding all those documents. And there was a guy who was the assistant or the associate deputy secretary of the faculty named Joe Holt, who, remarkable man, wonderful guy. And he had decided that it was pointless for us to continue to be the guardian of these classified documents, and that furthermore that we shouldn't have any classified research on campus anyhow, because our policy was to publish everything, and therefore we weren't allowing classified research on the campus through another mechanism. Therefore, we ought to get rid of all the classified documents and not have any classified depository. And so I was appointed to a committee
I'll be darned.
To justify this decision. And so there was I don't remember who else was on the committee, but I remember that that Len Van Ness was on that committee with me. And there was somebody from engineering, and I don't remember who that was now. It could have been Bob Marshall, the dean of engineering, or as he was associate dean at that time, because Kurt Wendt was dean. And there was somebody else on there, and we sat around a table, and we had only one committee meeting. We sat around a table in Van Hise up at the top there, in front of the safe, which was locked, and decided that we ought to get rid of everything. and that no more classified documents. And so we authorized Joe Holt to negotiate with the military and get rid of all the documents, and we closed down all of the classified research on campus as of about 1967 or 8.
And that was right before the student thing really heated up.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And that was when one of the early times where I got to know Len real well.
Hmm.
So anyhow,
well, that's very interesting.
Amazing how these things come up, pulling out of my memory when other issues come up like that.
So we're back at Sterling Hall now.
So we're back in Sterling Hall. We had the problem of finding space for the displaced physicists who really took the brunt.
They took the big hit. Yeah.
The math people were not really hurt very much, but we moved them out of there anyhow because. For security reasons and because the building had to be rebuilt and there was going to be a lot of noise and stuff there. So a lot of the physics stuff was moved out to Stoughton, to the physical science laboratory there. You familiar with that?
I've heard of it, but I don't know anything about it.
It's out there about 15 miles south of... You go straight out Park Street towards Oregon, and before you get to Oregon, you turn left and head over towards the lake, and there's the physical science laboratory there, which was, and I've spent a lot of...
You were saying when you were a young faculty member, you used to use their computers
to
do research.
Yeah, I used to go to the physical science laboratory and do research out there, and just a big barn of a place, but it's now the site of Aladdin, the synchrotron radiation center. And when we get to be chancellor, I'll tell you about that too. That was an interesting episode.
I'm writing that down.
We had a lot of problems associated with that bombing. It blew out all the windows in the, not only in the old chemistry building, but in the new chemistry building. Now, my office in the new chemistry building, which was a block away over on Johnson Street, faced the campus, and it was on the north side of the building. And years afterwards, I was pulling glass, broken glass, out of my computers, out of my chemicals shelves, out of my filing cabinet. It was just terrible. But it did a terrible lot of damage.
Well, one of the things Gordon Orr said is, he said, be sure to talk about the fact that it wasn't just Sterling Hall that got, that was, that took the brunt of it, obviously, but that buildings for blocks around, the windows were shattered. Yeah.
And interestingly enough, the shockwave skipped some buildings, and some buildings were completely left. You know, there's that church is between the old chemistry building and the new chemistry building on University Avenue. Mm-hmm. There's the church there on the corner of Charter and University.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have any damage at all, but the shockwave went right over the church and got the chemistry building.
Oh, interesting.
So it was a very interesting phenomenon. I was always going to go look at this to see if it was really true, but I heard that the bumper of the van that contained the explosives was found somewhere two blocks away in the swimming pool of Lathrop Hall.
Oh.
And that it had gone up in the air and had come down through the roof of the building.
I've never heard that.
I can't verify that. I was going to run down and look at that and see if it was really true, but I never got a chance to do that. But that was one of the stories that was going around.
Well, I think in the book Rads that came out about the bombing incident recently, it turned out that the Armstrongs were in a minibus and they were taking a left-hand corner on turn on Park and Dayton when the bomb went off, and their truck literally left the ground, levitated a foot in the air from the explosion, and they said it surprised the hell out of them because they didn't, you know, they never expected that it would be that monstrous a thing.
That was terrible.
Oh, it was just awful. And as you said earlier, it certainly changed the whole context, not only in Madison, but
the entire country.
I think that
was the incident that really woke up everybody to to what was going on in the Southeast Asia, and that our social fabric was coming apart as a result of it.
Now, you mentioned earlier that this was on August 22nd, and school opened when? Right after Labor Day?
I think in those days it opened after Labor Day.
Yeah, I think it was pretty early, like the 5th of September or something
right,
like that.
Yeah, but we had registration and things like that before Labor Day, I think.
How did that, in light of the bombing, what was that like on campus?
I don't remember, except it was just chaos. I was running all over the place, doing all kinds of things, running from one crisis to another. One incident, a guy escaped from the psychiatric ward in the hospital right in the middle of, within a couple of days of, after the bombing. There was still broken glass all over the place. And the the police... the fences were up everywhere. You couldn't get through. And this guy had decided that he wanted to get into the area there where the police had blocked it off, and he couldn't. And so he came up to Bascom, trying to find somebody who would give him, who would let him into the limited access area. And he couldn't find anybody in the first office that he came to, so he had a brick in his hand, and he started breaking the windows on the inside doors of Bascom Hall. Well, we heard this noise. Peter Bunn and I were talking there in the vice chancellor's office, heard breaking glass, and Peter ran out there, and the guy ran out the front of Bascom, and Peter was chasing him, and I was chasing Peter, running down towards Burge Hall, and he came up against one of these snow fences that had been constructed to keep people out of there, and we captured him and sent him back to the hospital. And it was, people did things like that. Well, that took up a whole morning because I had to talk to the police about it, and I had to talk to people in the medical school or then the hospital about him. And then we had to go worry about getting the windows fixed and the doors that he'd broken on the inside of Bascom. And, it was just one incident like that after another that screwed up our ability to deal with day-to-day issues of keeping the university.
You also had not only the police, but didn't you have the FBI in there?
Oh, yeah.
Ed
was the one that handled most of that.
Oh, he handled most of that. Okay. Along with Hansen, I suspect. Yeah.
Hansen and Ed.
So. Oh, boy. What a period.
Yeah, it was a difficult period. Now, the thing that you have to also recognize was that while that was going on, we were working on the medical school task force, you see. Our report came out in December of 1970.
That's right.
And so while I was trying to do that, I was holding meetings with the task force people and trying to get organized to get the money for a new hospital. All those kinds of things were going on simultaneously.
More difficult did that make your task? And not only logistically, of course, but in terms of fundraising and things like that. Did that?
I don't remember it being
like with the legislature or the governor or anything like that.
That particular issue, you see, we didn't really come to grips with getting more money for the hospital until a couple of years later. So that had pretty much died down. But what it did interfere with was our ability to get our own work done on campus. I had to get committees going to do the planning for the new hospital. Well, you couldn't get faculty members to sit down and talk about a new hospital when they're still talking about the bombing and the police and all that sort of thing. It was very difficult to get people focused on keeping the university functioning. By December, of course, it had calmed down considerably. But nevertheless, we still had a lot of work to do. We had to get the money to rebuild Sterling Hall. And
where'd you get that?
Well, the state government. I think a lot of that came out of an insurance fund that the building commission has. But nevertheless, we had to prepare new documentation. Mm-hmm. We had to get new plans. We had to put together proposals for the legislators to look at. It didn't require legislative approval in that sense, but it had to go to the governor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the people downtown got involved in it. It was time-consuming. Mm-hmm. It just took up a lot of time.
Now, we look back now, and it's easy to say that the Sterling Hall bombing certainly changed the whole tenor of the protest movement. But when did that become evident? Did that become evident? Were you concerned when it happened that it was going to escalate into something worse, or what?
Initially, I think the fear was that this was just the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
That was why we moved the math research center
right,
out to
of
the
course,
building
yeah.
and put guards in the front hall. We were working in our own microcosm. We didn't look at the national picture until much later. Or at least I did.